The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guests today on Getting to Yes And are Chloe Johnson and Koya Paz Brownrigg. Chloe is an associate professor of theater at Lake Forest College, which is my alma mater. She works as a writer, director, and performer throughout Chicago and is an ensemble member of the Neo Futurists. Koya Paz Browning is the associate professor of theater at DePaul University. She is the artistic director of Free Street Theater and co-founder of Teatro Luna and is a regular commentator on race, media, and pop culture for Vocalo Radio. They have a brand new book. It's called Ensemble Made Chicago, A Guide to Devised Theater. Chloe and Koya, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
I want to talk to each of you about the elements that make up the idea of ensemble-based creation, and we can focus on a handful of the companies that you profile in the book. But before we do that, I came to kind of a strange realization, or I think it's a realization while reading your book, that so many of these ensemble-based theaters that have lasted over decades were created by very strong, quirky individuals who, for good reasons and not so good reasons, ended up having to leave the theater companies they started. And I was talking to my wife, Anne, about this, and we were wondering if that's almost a necessary aspect to sustained innovation in the space. Like, you need a uniquely gifted individual to get things started, but if they're successful, the ensemble they built can't keep them in the fold. And I say this knowing that that was actually true at Second City with the founders. And I'm curious just if that is anything that you thought of when you were putting together the book.
Wow. That's a good question. Yeah, I feel like you should take it because you founded a company, and I actually have never been around on the ground floor, but you've been through that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the work of starting a company often rests in the vision of one or two people who really are kind of like pushing to get it done. But the very spirit of an ensemble is that, you know, you can't have sort of a mad genius as the leader. It would be counter to the goals of the work you're trying to do. And so I do think that sometimes it is frustrating for people who have, you know, maybe a desire to be leaders or seen as visionaries or seen as sort of at the forefront of the work. If the work is really going well, they get supplanted by it. It can be a kind of tense dynamic, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, having known both Paul Sills and David Shepherd, and we just lost David Shepherd recently,
yes.
Paul, I think, left Second City and was happy to leave to then found Story Theater and really wasn't so stuck in the past because he needed to always innovate sort of outside the lines. David, even though, you know, he founded Compass and wasn't necessarily involved in the founding of Second City, though, is certainly an important figure, you know, then went on for Improv Olympic but couldn't stay there and always seemed to harbor this sort of like, I don't know, a sort of wandering resentment. And with some of the figures in the book, and you don't go into all the politics, and I appreciate that, and we won't in this, but I know some of these people who have that same wandering resentment, right? You know what I'm saying?
I mean, it's funny because we purposely, you know, we had a sort of tricky balance where we want to create a usable tool. And we often joke that the follow-up to the book should be why they broke up, because so few of the people who founded these companies are continuing to work at the company. Or you see these really, we do go into just sort of the overview of this a little bit in the book, right, of like, it's actually really hard work to create work collaboratively and to make decisions that favor a collective rather than an individual. That takes constant emotional labor and negotiation, and it's really, really hard. But we didn't want to, in any individual company, to go into the sort of like scandal of like, and then so-and-so told so-and-so this, and they never were in a room together again. You know, right, we tried to be a little more delicate because we want it to be an optimistic and usable tool. We really believe in this kind of work and what it can accomplish. So we don't want to discourage people, but I also think like we can't be overly idealistic. It's very, very hard to be in a relationship with anyone, much less a whole theater company.
Right, right, right. So in the introduction of your book, you introduce the reader to this long tradition that is particularly unique to Chicago theater, which reimagines how theater is actually created. You write that it is, quote, performance processes that center on collective creation, authored not by one but by many, by everyone in the room, end quote. And I should add, that includes the audience. And I know both of you have been exposed to the more traditional play creation. You've studied that in school and elsewhere. But talk to us about what's different about ensemble creation. And Chloe, let's start with you. How is this different to the way that a lot of other people make theater?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the number one difference is this idea that you're going to do away with the hierarchy, that you're going to do away with kind of really rigidly defined roles where your only responsibility is your sort of named position, and that you're not kind of supposed to step outside of your lane. And, you know, we know that, look, all theater is collaborative in some ways, but we also think that there is this kind of particular way of doing things in which you throw out those titles. And I think what's interesting, and in some ways this, I think, calls back to your first question about, like, the irony at the heart of a lot of these companies, which is this tension between a kind of strong personality and a collective ethos, is that there's lots of different kinds of collaboration. And so, like, a company, for instance, it's in the book, like Looking Glass, nowadays they maybe do make theater in a more traditional way. There's a clear writer, director, actor, but that the way that they put together a season, that the way that they share roles in between projects is much more collaborative. So I think that it's really about saying you are not just this one thing. You can contribute in lots of different ways. And that embracing that idea then kind of opens up the possibility of lots of different kinds of voices in the room in many different ways, bringing in voices and stories from people that weren't necessarily thinking of themselves as theater makers. So if you do away with that kind of rigid definition of roles, then it just opens up so many possibilities.
And I think that it applies not just on stage, but off stage, right? And I think people would be surprised how connected we all are in the Chicago theater community. So even like when I started in 1988, I was able to have conversations with Rock Schulfer and Bob Falls at the Goodman, just as I was talking to the guys at stage left in these little, you know, sort of hole in the wall. And Koya, talk a bit about you. So we're going to get into ensemble as it relates to this play creation or devised theater, but also it's sort of a cultural mix that sort of blends the whole Chicago theater community together, even people who are doing wildly different kinds of work.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I'm sort of historically resistant to the idea of the Chicago theater community. I think that often we function as distinct communities where there isn't always a lot of visible overlap. Mm-hmm. So what was really surprising to me as we were delving into this research, actually, is how many people had either worked together in a previous company or a previous training facility. That sounds like a mental hospital.
You might be right.
Feel that way sometimes. had gone to, you know, studied with the same practitioners, or, you know, so that we found sort of surprising overlap between companies like Southside Ignoramus Quartet, which are operating out of a tent in Pilsen, and, Looking Glass, or, Second City,
yeah.
You know, the founder of SICK trained at Second City, you know, so
yeah.
That there's all of these ways in which Chicago has been a particularly vibrant place for the development of this practice. And that's part of what we were curious about in the book is like, why is so much of this in Chicago, a city that gets actually very little credit for how much original performance work it creates?
Right. And I'm thinking now back to my first question and how it relates is also we're so process oriented. And you have you quote Mike Nichols in the book talking about Paul Sills, and you quote him saying that Sills always wandered away well before opening night because he had no interest at all in results, only the process. And that was also true of Del Close. Because I was hosting The Room when Del Close was directing his last show at Second City, and he wasn't even around the last 3 weeks of the process when, as you guys know, that mostly directors are like living at the theater the last 3 weeks of process to tie up, especially a devised work. So I think this idea of ensemble is also this sort of detached devotion where process is more important than product.
Oh, go ahead, Chloe.
Go ahead. No, Chloe, please.
No. You guys, I think we're going in two different directions, so you go first.
Well, I think that, though, I always want to put that asterisk next to it because
yeah.
I think that one of the negative stereotypes people have about devised or ensemble-created work is that it's entirely process-based.
Right.
So it's really good for, like, a high school theater company, but nothing that an audience would really want to see. And I want to say a challenge that there are some really, really excellent youth-based ensemble device companies in Chicago. It's one of the things we excel at.
Yep.
But I think that ensemble process can create really aesthetically sophisticated and beautiful things for an audience. But it is true that it is a way of making theater that values process as much as product and is as creative with process as it is with product. So as Chloe was saying before, we're not coming into The Room with a pre-established idea of how it has to go because that's just how things go. We make what we need for the project we're doing.
Yeah,
I think it's also about a commitment to a long-term relationship. I mean, not always. Sometimes people come together for one project. But I think, you know, a lot of, certainly what I've experienced is the great joy of being an ensemble member, mm-hmm. of kind of developing that shorthand with people, of knowing that there's a process for a show that goes on for whatever, however many months. But that's actually just a smaller part of a longer relationship that's going to go on for many years. So yes, the process might sort of seem to dissipate, but it's you have to take the long view in a lot of these situations.
And you actually quote a very smart woman named Ann Libra from Second City.
Very smart.
Very brilliant.
And beautiful, too.
A beautiful, brilliant person I'm married to. And she writes, she talks about this all the time, that ensemble is, she sees it as a practice, not a particular group of people, which is so true at Second City because, you know, the minute you master your craft, you leave. But Second City doesn't end. And because we have this sort of, such a long arc that people really cling to the idea that they are lifelong alumni of the theater. They wear that with a badge, and you know, we're the most sort of commercial of all the theaters you talk about. But really, we haven't changed the aesthetic of creation. It's still completely ensemble based. And I always say to people, it's like, in what world does a practice that is so focused on taking care of the other players produce this many stars?
Mm.
So
I think that is why.
Yeah.
You know, because it doesn't operate on a scarcity model or this idea like there can only be one person who is the lead or who is going to be outstanding in this. If everybody turns out to be excellent and vibrant in the scene, then the audience can see that. There's room for, you know, people to play to their strengths, to pop in the ways that really showcase what they're great at. And I think that one of the reasons I don't like working with sort of traditional scripted work is because I want to make a world where I'm welcoming the best of what everybody has to offer and sharing that with the audience.
So you mentioned the Southside Ignoramus Quartet, which in many ways was built in reaction to the experience at Second City of its founder, David Pinter, who spent 2 years there, but really felt disconnected culturally. And I don't mind talking about this because, like, I've lived this and seen how it's played out over a long period of time. But talk to us a bit about the challenges that they felt and why they created this different thing.
Yeah, I think we're used to the other thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we can really only speak to what they talked about in our interview, which is that, you know, David's experience of being at Second City when he was there was that, you know, a lot of times ethnicity became the joke or, you know, and I think that that's something we have become increasingly aware of not doing in our current moment, you know, so I also think that we've seen a lot of growth in companies across the city in terms of trying to do better, you know, or that, you know, making jokes about the South Side or certain populations on the South Side didn't land because the audience wasn't familiar with what was happening, or like the people in the scene didn't know how to pick up the tone of that. And I think David was really craving a place to make work for the people that he grew up with and lived with, you know, and was seeing a lot of really talented, funny people, you know, telling jokes and stories at parties that were never kind of invited or even knew how to participate in more formal theater. And so starting the Southside Economics Quartet, literally building a tent in his parents' backyard, was his answer to that. And I love the spirit, you know, of not like, we don't have to knock anything down. We just need to make the thing we want to see.
Yeah, so that my experience, you know, because when I came in and produced at Second City in 1992, I even though I worked there, I was an outsider coming in, bringing in outside ideas, challenging the system, and then suddenly you find yourself you're the man, and I'm like, well, that's not why I did this. But what I realized over a period of time is we are actually giving the tools for you to challenge the establishment. And sometimes, oftentimes, you can't do that within the walls of the establishment. You have to sort of go out and build your thing. And if you look at even certainly diverse communities is the thing that we're talking about right now. But even with the foundation of Improv Olympic and the Annoyance, these were people who were challenging the aesthetic, the look, the sensibility of what Second City had become. And, you know, what we did in the early 90s was say, oh, yeah, can we bring some of that? We'd like some of that anarchy inside our walls. And I see that as a theme that's run through since that time period to greater or less degree. As leaders that we've been able to support, provoke, and sometimes we failed with that, and that's absolutely true. But I do think it's important that people build their thing.
Yeah, and especially because, you know, in some ways we're always facing the same problems, but we're finding different solutions. Like something that's interesting about, you know, my home company, the Neo-Futurists, is that it's ensemble-based theater, but the ensemble, you know, in like Second City, changes continually every few years. And so, you know, you can be gone for a few years and then come back and do a show, and you see people struggling with the same problems, whether it's like, you know, how to stage a movement piece or like how to run a meeting better that you were negotiating 7 years ago. And there's a part of you that wants to jump in and be like, oh, no, we figured this out. And then there's another part of you that's like, oh, it's so cool to get to watch another, usually younger, group of people kind of find a new, often better solution to that problem. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we're all trying to make things in the world that make sense to people and that people want to come see. And so there's something really joyful about watching that problem get solved in so many different ways over the years, especially when, you know, you spent a couple of years or decades watching this kind of work happen.
Yeah. So Koya, you are at Free Street Theater, which was started by one of these characters, Patrick Henry, who I met in the 80s when I was just starting out the Chicago theater community, and who I recall being delighted and scared of. So I don't know if does that description fit with your knowledge of Patrick?
Well, I've never met Patrick. Sadly, he passed away well before I ever even knew that Free Street existed. But that's been, you know, I always say that one of the interesting things for me being at Free Straight, which turned 50 in 2019, is it's like being an archaeologist, you know, constantly
yes.
trying to find out what was happening, who were these people. You know, we have literally thousands of photographs with no attribution. I have no idea who any of these performers are. I, you know, constantly spending my spare time digging in the archive, trying to find it, you know, but like everything that I heard about Patrick Henry as we were working on this book and also preparing for Free Straight's anniversary was that he was a person who had a lot of ideas and passion and, you know, I think everybody kind of loved him, but also wanted him to be happy. If that makes sense. You know, like,
yes.
you don't want to disprove him, you know, and I think actually his, the you know, Ron Bagansky, who followed him, sort of similarly, you know, like
right.
there's so many stories about what personality he was. You know, everyone describes him as a brilliant artist, and but also a little bit intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
The jury's out on what kind of artistic director at Free Straight I've been. It might is a lot more. I prefer not to be the kind of person who stands out. But, you know, one of the things that was interesting in writing this book, too, is that we included Teatro Luna, which is the company I founded and I'm no longer with. And nobody at the company was there when I was there except for one person. And it was really strange to sit in on their rehearsals and to hear them talk about their practice. And I'm like, what are you saying? That's
yep.
not right. And I'm like, no, I guess that is right now. You know,
yep.
that's who they are now. And so it made me think a lot about what it must feel like for people who were working with Free Straight before to hear me talk about our work or see us working now. I think we don't own the companies we make. We can just sort of hope that what we've seeded grows something, you know, that we can all be proud of.
Well, I think, you know, so much of the work in Chicago is a laboratory. We're allowed to be innovative because we're not on the coasts. There's a number of reasons, right? And we also have the spirit. And it's not just theater, right? Whether it's house music, you think about Playboy, you know, all the sort of inventive, just amazing innovation that's happened out of the city. There's something about the DNA there. But part of what we're dealing with is this tension between leadership and ensemble. And you write in the book, quote, even in the most collaborative environment, there is a place for leadership. That leadership might be about finding the source material, shaping the writing, polishing the stage images, even just scheduling rehearsals. So an absolute need for having that kind of structure in a art form that is resistant to structure, hard to be structure. And there's some lesson in life with that, right? I mean, there's some lesson about, in Second City, we use the term follow the follower, and you certainly talk about Viola Spolin and Neva Boyd, where all this stuff came from. But this idea that we have to lead and often abandon our leadership in the same moment, I find that unique to our art form, and perhaps can be translated into all kinds of worlds, whether it be political, civic, in a resistant movement or social, you know, cause.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because I also think that it's important. I think sometimes the way we talk about success and failure, especially with artistic projects, we need to be thoughtful about, because if you have an organization that truly does have some sort of shared governance system, it very well might limit growth in particular mm-hmm. ways. But, you know, I can think of a couple of companies, and actually a couple that aren't even in the book, that have been around in Chicago for 30 years now, and maybe their bank account is still in a safe box underneath somebody's bed,
right.
but they're still doing it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they're mentoring young artists. And so I do think that, like, even without a strong leader, you can keep going. It's just that your form of success might look a little bit different. I don't know. What
yeah.
do you think, Koya?
I mean, I have spent the whole of my kind of career as an ensemble theater maker as an artistic director rather than a non-administrative ensemble member, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You know, like thinking about some of my longtime collaborators are really brilliant artists, but they're not the ones who are worrying about the budget or the marketing in the way that I have been throughout my whole career. But I I think that maybe when you're working in and committed to an ensemble process, your idea of leadership is making sure that it all works, not necessarily that it goes the way you want it to. So I know at Free Street, we renegotiate on every project, sort of what it's going to look like, how we want it to work, what we want the flow to be. And it's always open for revision and change, even in process, because ultimately we want to make something beautiful for an audience, but we also want the people making it to feel like it was a fair and generative and exciting experience.
When I was, after I finished reading the book and I was doing my notes for our conversation, I realized that like a couple weeks ago, we had this all staff meeting at Second City because we had gone through this process for creating a new vision and mission statement for the whole company. And we're very much basing our philosophies of the company as a business on the sort of artistic elements that we use in our improv created work. And so my section that they asked me to address was ensemble. And I'm like, oh, I just did this. And I want to kind of read you, because it's not long, what I spoke to about the company and get your feedback with regard to all the research you did. So this is what I got up and we had five different, you know, areas, and mine was ensemble. And I said, Google did this two-year initiative to discover what made for high-performing teams, and none of their assumptions ended up being the deciding factor. It wasn't having a team made up of Ivy League graduates or teams that were great friends. It ended up being teams that operated with a high degree of psychological safety. Basically, ensemble is psychological safety. It's having each other's backs. It's bringing a brick, not a cathedral. It's having a bias for action, but also knowing that to innovate, you need a space to reflect and change. Sheldon Patinkin used to note that we all heard the adage that your team was only as good as its weakest member. At Second City, we don't believe that. We believe that your team is only as good as its ability to compensate for its weakest member, because if each of us will have to be the weakest member at some point. And in ensembles, that's when it's our job to pick up each other. In an ensemble, all of us are better than one of us. And it's vital to know that this isn't just a rule for the stage. It's a set of behaviors and understandings that should permeate the bar, the kitchen, the boardrooms, and the offices. And guess what? We're going to fuck this up. All of us, a lot. That's inevitable. And that's why we have our fellow ensemble members. This thing only breaks down if all of us bail on each other. And in my 30 years of this company, I've never seen that happen, not once. So that's my thing to deliver this sort of corporate application. I'm just curious if anything resonates with you in your research with some of those ideas.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, I think what you wrote is really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. It reminded me of a company that is actually not in our book, but is the precursor to one of the companies, Goat Island, which doesn't exist anymore. There's a beautiful piece that I often teach called Letter to a Young Practitioner. And it's, you know, about being a collaborator. And there's a line in that about beware of talent. Beware of the brilliant person, you know, look for the person that can be humble and can really work with you. And I found myself thinking about that a lot as I heard what you were reading. And it's something that I know personally, that took me a lot of years to understand. Like, yeah. I probably first read that essay when I was in my 20s. And I was like, well, don't you want to work with the best people? But the older I get, too, the more I understand the value of that, the more I understand, especially with this kind of work, how there are things that are more important than brilliance.
Yeah, and what's best? Because I think, you know, the way our human brains work is we tend to enjoy the patterns because they make sense to us, but then we're missing a truth that's maybe new because it's not recognizable. And I think when you have a true ensemble, it's almost like a nudge to make you consider the other, the more silent, the less loud.
Yeah, I mean, we know that theater people, you know, and I put that in quotes, theater people can take up a lot of space. And sometimes in that kind of like push to be on, we are not always paying attention to who's not being heard or whose voice is being silenced just because someone else is talking. And I think that when ensembles work really well, it's when they've understood how to make room for each other as all of us are. I mean, the reality is like someone who's an extrovert and really, you know, needs to take up space. You know, some people talk in order to think. Other people need to think before they talk. So we have to make space for everyone to function well, and we can. I mean, that's entirely possible. What's not good is if we're just sort of mad about how things went, you know, and I think that's what I think the healthiest ensembles do really well, is just sort of like, no, like, okay, here's what Koya's going to need to do. Okay, here's what Chloe's going to need to do. Here's what Kelly's going to need to do. Now, okay, now what are we going to do?
Yeah, yeah, completely. Yeah. Before I ask you each for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast, I would love it if you would talk to us about the Albany Park Theater Project. And I say this because I live right there. I'm a fan of their work. I think they're really interesting. And in particular, you talk about this production that put the audience basically in school with these kids.
Yeah. Go ahead, that's for you.
That's for me. Yeah, I mean, I think that Albany Park Theater Project is one of those examples of youth-made work that is, you know, these young people are producing stunning, stunning performance.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is, like, I think Chloe and I have both been longtime fans of APTP. You know, I joke a lot that I hate theater, which is scandalous for someone who makes their living in theater.
Yes.
And I teach theater, and I'm all in. But for the most part, I'm not that interested in sort of a typical, you know, two-act play in a formal theater. It does not interest me that much. Of course, there are some excellent plays. And APTP has always been on my list of companies that I would see read the phone book, you know, because I trust that they're going to do something really beautiful and interesting. They're all young people. They are multiracial, most of them from immigrant families. They've done really innovative work thinking about, like, how to be in community as a community.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's so much that all of us can learn from them and from other, you know, about Face Youth Theater is another company in the book that does a lot of youth-based work. I think we cannot discount the innovation that young people will bring to the stage if we let them.
I agree. And if I could jump in here, something that both of those companies have in common as well is a commitment to performance ethnography. And both of those companies had a relationship with Dwight Conkergood, who was one of the essentially co-creators of performance studies, and that's Koya and I both have our background in performance studies at Northwestern University. And this idea that you would do ethnographic research and then not just, you know, write it up in a book, but create a performance out of it. And about face theater was founded by somebody who had studied that methodology, and Albany Park Theater Project sort of came in contact, I think, with Dwight Conkergood later. But what I find so fascinating is that I love what Koya, what you just said about, like, the way that the youth kind of bring these ideas to life, like their artistry bring the ideas to life, because I do think, as someone who's read a lot of kind of performance ethnography theory, and again, this is something that's a very Chicago-based methodology, that it's those are the two examples of it working best, at least in my mind. Like, the most kind of compelling theater is most compelling performance ethnography that I've seen have been those two companies.
Yeah, there is a great...
But I will say a lot of the companies in the book probably have some of that history, you know, like APTP, About Face, Honeypot Performance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
Out of that tradition, Free Street, Teatro Luna, Neo-Futurist.
Sure. I mean, Melanin.
I mean, like, so many of these people coming, I think, out of that particular bent at Northwestern of not just performing literature, but performing ethnography and community stories. What's amazing to me is how different everybody's work is. You know, that you think about that impulse to want to almost scientifically create, like, to collect the data, you know, like, what is the fullest version of the story that we can tell in all of its nuance? And then the aesthetics of it go in wildly different directions.
Well, and an attention to how you collect the data, that you do it in very strategic ways. And I know, like, that's something APTP takes a lot of care with, About Face Youth Theater is taking a lot of care with, yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think is I'm going out on a limb here, but some of the work that my wife and I have been doing with the behavioral science community is recognizing that a lot of, at least the improv-based work at Second City that they've been exposed to, is speaking to the human condition. So if you think about, you know, the idea in behavioral economics of the default behavior of most people is to do nothing. Well, the exact opposite of that is yes and. You know, it's and it doesn't mean that you actually have to believe it. It's that you say it enough and you do it, which is kind of how we teach that. We're like, it doesn't matter if you actually believe this. As long as you are forced to do it, you will get to the place. And that's what happens. And I would suspect if you look at a wide swath of well, certainly at Northwestern with performance studies, what I know of it, and you know, more so through Anne and other people who I've known go through that program. But then that has also spread through some of these other companies and their work, is that they are speaking to the human condition. They are speaking to how humans behave. And when we listen to that and we do our work, it's springing from a similar process, but the process is revealing wildly different truths because we're all living wildly different truths in our own worlds. Maybe?
Yeah. I mean, that made me think about, I like this idea that I hear you sort of talking around or maybe saying quite explicitly, like the way improv might make you a better person in
yes,
a way.
I'm saying
and
that.
It makes me think about something I actually heard you say, Kelly, a couple of years ago at a talk at Lake Forest, that it occurs to me often about how rarely we are carefully listening to the person that we're in conversation with.
Yeah.
Like if somebody pressed you, like how often you would really be able to repeat the last thing that person said because we're so focused on what we want to say next,
mm-hmm.
and how you have to have your ears open in that way. When you're doing an improv scene and how often I don't have my ears open that way in my day-to-day life. And it is like a little technique I found myself practicing a little bit more in everyday life since I heard you give that talk about improv.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, I mean, and especially, you know, when you are of the advantaged class, when you're of the privileged class of which I am, it becomes even more convenient to not listen. Because you point this out, ensemble made work is hard. I mean, I often tell this story where Tina Fey's husband, Jeff Richmond, who directed at Second City, was, you know, halfway through a process and just left me a note on my desk that this is the most inefficient way to create art ever. Why do we do it this way? And I was like, I know what he means, right? This is like, what are we doing to ourselves? But we then experience what it brings about, which is something it never would have if we had just had one person with pen and paper. So, you know, and this is the equivalent to that, which is like, you know, if you want to get into shape, you're going to have to experience some pain. I don't know anything great, love, wisdom, that didn't come with a whole lot of pain to get to that place. So it's more than theater, I think, and I think we all know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm actually really excited about hearing your yes and story. So Koya, can we start with you? Give us a yes and story.
I'm excited to hear Koya's story.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited to hear Koya's story too. Koya and I were texting each other before this. Like, oh my God, what's your yes and story? I'm going to cheat. I will tell you that my yes and story is this book.
Okay, that's not cheating. That's not cheating.
Because, you know, Chloe and I didn't even know each other when we started working on this. Like, I look back on doing this, and it was such a leap of faith to be like, hey, should we do this thing? Yeah. Should we do this other thing? Yeah. And we'll add this. Yeah. Next thing you know, we go from meeting each other once over coffee to plan giving a keynote at a very small conference to spending like over 3 years writing a book together, and not once in that whole process did we have any conflict. I mean, that sounds like the weirdest thing, but I think that Chloe is so great about sort of seeing what's valuable and what you're offering, which I think is so much of the spirit of yes and, you know, of like, yes, I see that can be a thing, and I will welcome it with this other idea, you know? And if you have that spirit of like pulling out what somebody is offering and seeing what you can add to it, it really is like a really like fun and generative way of existing with a person. Now, that's not to say that there weren't moments where we had to scale it back from the place where we had taken it, you know? But I just sort of like, I'm amazed at the kind of like fact that we did this, Chloe. We had a baby together.
You did have a baby together. Strangers who had a baby.
We had
you actually had babies while we were writing
that.
Yeah, you
know, that, like,
yeah, no babies, like, too.
Yeah.
Sure.
A lot happens.
Yeah.
A lot happens.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I, you know, I'm glad that I had a backup story, Koya, because I was maybe,
that was
my first thought was the book. Yeah, I mean, and what you said before about, like, the, Kelly, you were saying, and I think you were quoting someone else, I can't remember who now, about the trust that you have to have in the ensemble relationship was absolutely, my experience of working on this book was that, you know, I felt like I could make a mistake, you know, or put out a bad idea. And I hope you felt that way, Koya, as well, because there were some difficult things we had to hash through as well.
Yeah.
So it's so important to have those spaces to have the bad ideas essentially. And especially, you know, because we wanted this book to honor the artists within it, you know, that was so important to us.
Is that,
but don't you think it makes me think about, like, one of the advantages of yes and as a philosophy is, like, okay, so say I have a bad idea. If you tell me no, then I'm just going to, like, hold on to that idea. Like, it would have been really good, you know? But if you're like, sure, let's just keep playing that forward, I'll come to my own realization, like, whoa, we are making a terrible mistake. And I've come to it, you know, like, I haven't had to have somebody tell me, like, I don't have to have any resentment because I've, like, someone, you've, like, given me the opportunity to kind of, like, play out the idea for a little bit, and then you realize, like, okay, I think we can let this go.
I have the antithesis of this, which is my family has been binge-watching old episodes of seasons of Project Runway, and every time they're given a collaboration challenge, it all falls to pieces. They cannot. These designers are so individually focused that and the ones who do well and win the challenge are always the ones who take each other's ideas and build on it, you know, and I'm like, I want a Tim Gunn for life. I want some, like, someone who's going to come in and, like, be able to advise me. And he does, and he tries to get them to sort of collaborate. But you realize that, especially in these art forms or these, you know, processes that are so focused on the individual genius, that they are missing out on a whole other array of learnings. You know, and I think somewhere in the book you talk about multiple intelligences, and I love that phrase. I'm like, oh, that's what the ensemble releases, is these, that we think of intelligence as one thing, and it's not. There's multiple intelligences. Chloe, I didn't want to, like, was that your yes and story, or did you have another one you were gonna pop to us?
I mean, I that was one of them, but just in case I had a backup. No, I mean, for me it was it was joining the neo-futurists. Mm-hmm. It was something, you know, I was in my early 20s and terrified. And I just, when you asked for the yes and story, I just, like, flashed back to when I first joined the company, and it was so scary. It was like, I went to a rehearsal on a Tuesday night, and that was my one preparation. And then that Friday night I had to perform in front of, like, 180 people, you know, material that we'd maybe run through once. And, you know, that's the writing schedule. And I remember standing outside of the theater, like, across the street, looking at it and being like, maybe it'll burn down right now. Maybe I won't have to, like, actually go do that show. And sort of that, like, forcing myself to, like, cross Ashland Avenue, go up the stairs, do the show, when everything in my body told me it was a bad idea to do it. I was so scared. Was, you know, set my life on a particular course that, like, led me to Koya and this book and this podcast, and, like, you know, something I feel just incredibly grateful to get to do and to get to talk about this stuff after all these years, to have that be such a big part of how I spend my time. So, yeah.
The book
it worked out. It sure did.
The book is called Ensemble Made Chicago, A Guide to Devised Theater. Chloe and Koya, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, I've been working in a home.